Hi, my name's Ed Renane and I'm an Adult Safeguarding Manager with the NHS Clinical Commissioning Groups in Derby and Derbyshire. And in this second of two podcasts, we will continue to look at self-neglect. Again, we are very fortunate to have Susie Bray and Michael Preston-Shute with us to help us understand some of the research. So I'll let them introduce themselves. Susie.
Hello. I'm Emerita Professor of Social Work at the University of Sussex and I practice as an independent consultant in adult safeguarding.
Hello, I'm Michael. I'm Emeritus Professor of Social Work at the University of Bedfordshire, independent chair of two safeguarding boards in Brent and in Lewisham, and also an independent consultant.
Thanks very much. Thanks for being here. Your research into self-neglect carried out for the Department of Health included a third colleague, Dr. David Orr, but looked at reviews of the literature, discussion with practitioners and safeguarding specialists, and interviews with people who self-neglect. Your findings have been highly influential in the development of policy and practice in this area of work. As discussed in podcast one, Susie and Michael have identified six key challenges on which the research findings cast some light. Podcast one set the scene by looking at the first three challenges, those relating to direct work with the individual. In this second podcast, we will talk about the second three challenges, those relating to organisational factors that impact on self-neglect work. We will end with a summary of this subject. So my first question would be, turning now to the first of these three organisational challenges, in the past we have heard you talk about the perfect storm in relation to an organisation's approach to self-neglect. Could you please expand on this?
Well, let's look at the organisational context in which self-neglect practice takes place, regardless of which agency it is. One common theme that unites everybody is resource constraint and this context of austerity that has really bitten very deep into across health and adult social care and across a whole range of services that are also implicated in self-neglect. We see workflow models that are characterised by an expectation of short, time-limited involvement with individuals, a lack of continuity that makes it very difficult to build relationships over time. In local authorities, care management is the approach to assessing care and support needs, but also across the whole spectrum, performance management is key, and that what counts in performance is often turnover rather than depth of relationship and degrees of change in an individual's life. We see thresholds that limit preventive work. We see charging policies that, applied inflexibly, can be very off-putting to an individual who might have been persuaded to take a small care and support package, but when they learn that they have a financial contribution to make, will say no, forget it. And then we have features of the local care market. We know that the care market is quite challenged in terms of the supply of expertise within domiciliary care providers who are able to engage with this very, very tricky area of practice. So we've got a system that's under severe pressure in which the approaches that we know work in self-neglect are difficult to resource and implement. Then set that alongside the fact that many people who self-neglect are terrified of losing their independence or terrified of state intervention and are therefore reluctant to engage anyway. So the temptation to say, oh, you're saying it's all fine, you don't want any help, thank goodness, we can walk away, is just too great sometimes. That juxtaposition between the context and the nature of people's self-neglect experience and their fear, that's the perfect storm. So the research shows us that without adjustments in the approaches that organisations take to managing workloads, practitioners will struggle to use approaches that we know work in self-neglect, that slow burn, relationship-based, trust-building work. So some of the key features of organisational support for self-neglect practice have to be, first of all, a recognition for the practitioners about how it feels. It feels lonely, helpless, risky and frustrating. Practitioners feel exposed and uncertain. So recognition of that personal impact through strong supervision and support is really important. Equally important is access to specialist advice, whether that's advice from another professional in a different discipline or whether it's advice from legal advisors. People need time for a slow burn approach. So it's important to try and think about a way of managing workflow that permits repeat visits and longer term engagement. Not with each and every case, that's for sure unrealistic, but with very high risk, high profile, complex cases. And we need organisations to recognise the need for places and spaces to discuss these very difficult, tricky and challenging situations so that we can, practitioners can have a greater degree of shared risk management and decision making across the spectrum of the agencies involved.
Okay, thank you for that. You've mentioned the importance of legal literacy in supporting self-neglect work. Could you tell us what that you mean by that?
What emerges from Safeguarding Adult reviews and from our conversations with practitioners is the importance of people understanding their roles and their responsibilities, and the importance also of understanding other agencies' roles and responsibilities in a context where self-neglect practice is every agency's responsibility. So it's essential for there to be clear understandings between the agencies of the legal powers and duties that could be involved in working with self-neglect. And this is a complex picture, but it provides a framework for both negotiated and, when necessary, imposed interventions and solutions. So we start with the legal rules for assessment, whether that's of needs for care, support and protection as provided for within the Care Act 2014, or of mental capacity provided for in the Mental Capacity Act 2005, or of mental health and Mental Health Act assessments as provided by the Mental Health Act 1983. And it's important that individual agencies and multi-agency partnerships consider all that could be done by using one or more of those three legal mandates. But in the event that one cannot secure an individual's engagement and severe risks to others remain, then you may well be in the realm of imposed interventions, and here you may need to bring in environmental health, housing, the local authority or the police in relation to antisocial behaviour, or the RSPCA in relation to animal welfare legislation. And in certain circumstances, you may need to have recourse to the Court of Protection, where an individual lacks capacity over relevant decisions, but where either there isn't agreement on how to act in that person's best interests, or there is agreement, but actually it's proving difficult to implement a best interest decision. Or you may need to have recourse to the High Court for the exercise of its inherent jurisdiction, for example, where you believe that an individual may be the recipient of coercive or controlling behaviour, or where that individual may be acting under undue duress. And throughout, you need an understanding of when agencies can share information, because that is absolutely crucial to good communication. And the Data Protection Act 1998 does not prohibit the sharing of information to prevent or detect a crime, for example, financial abuse, or to safeguard somebody from serious harm. And you may also need to be aware of the circumstances in which a power of entry can be obtained in order to enter premises. But just because something can be done lawfully doesn't mean that it necessarily should be done. So legal literacy comes from not just knowing what the legal rules are, but connecting them with professional ethics. What do you think is the right thing to do in any given circumstances? And making decisions that are informed by the principles of human rights, equality and social justice. And for that you need to have multi-agency conversations.
Thank you very much for that. You've emphasised that effective practice in self-neglect is a multi-agency undertaking. What do we know about how agencies work together?
One of the sources of evidence about the effectiveness or otherwise of how agencies work together comes from Safeguarding Adult Review findings, and in relation to self-neglect, we know that there are at least 134 Safeguarding Adult Reviews, or before the CARE Act, serious case reviews. And a number of themes emerge from this collection of reviews. Some reviews highlight that agencies work in silos and they work on parallel lines. The work is uncoordinated. So a GP may be unsighted on what a district nurse is doing, for example, or primary care may not know of the involvement of environmental health or of adult social care. Part and parcel of that could be failures of communication within an agency as well as across agencies. And in significant cases of harm, a lack of leadership within agencies and between agencies, a failure to identify a lead agency that will take responsibility for coordinating the efforts of the multi-agency partnership. There are, in some cases, failures of escalation and failures of challenge. So adult social care, adult safeguarding may have decided not to initiate a Section 42 inquiry, and agencies merely accept that decision rather than challenging it. Or an agency might decide to close a case because an individual doesn't engage. And again, that decision is not challenged or escalated. We also know that individuals who self-neglect do not always live alone. They are members of families. Some adults are parents or grandparents, so there are children involved. And here it's important that the multi-agency partnership thinks family, and that includes involving children's social care or child and adolescent mental health, for example. We also know that not all agencies are clear about their roles and responsibilities, particularly their legal powers and duties, as we've just highlighted. So being clear on your roles and responsibilities, and being clear what other agencies can do by way of statutory intervention emerges from Safeguarding Adult Reviews. And unsurprisingly, the challenge of mental capacity assessments, the failure to do assessments, or the failure to review assessments that have been done. And then finally, and to quote a coroner, the collective omission of the mundane and the obvious. Use your powers of observation, use your powers of assessment, be curious about what you see, because what might appear to be mundane and obvious might actually be an important clue in what is going on in a particular situation.
So we need to think about the components of a robust interagency infrastructure, and we need to start at the top really with a shared strategic ownership and understanding about self-neglect. We mentioned in the first podcast that the self-neglect is now firmly under the remit of the Safeguarding Adults boards, and that has brought self-neglect in from the cold, as it were, and made it much more possible for boards together to work on developing that shared strategic ownership, so that self-neglect becomes everybody's business, just like every other form of abuse and neglect. But that strategic level agreement needs to filter down through to that middle territory about clarity of roles and relationships, the referral pathways. What should an individual in practitioner do if they are worried about somebody who is self-neglectful? How should that concern be passed into the system? Who should be responding to it? That needs to be crystal clear. Equally, we need to ensure that there are forums for shared risk management, the importance of bringing agencies together around the table to think together about how they can collectively use their powers and duties to think about intervention. We may need to be talking to the commissioning branches of agencies, particularly local authorities, particularly CCGs, about whether in their commissioning strategy they are reflecting the goals and objectives related to self-neglect, whether they are in fact purchasing the form of services that are going to be helpful in making positive approaches to this particular area of practice. And then we need to turn all those strategic and in principle policies into operational reality. We need to be thinking about the training, supervision, the support that can be given to practitioners on the ground. We need to be thinking, teams need to be thinking about how they can make space in some cases for relationship-based work. And we need to think very carefully in complex cases that involve a number of agencies, how are we going to ensure case coordination across the agencies and how are we going to ensure leadership of that specific case. So the interagency context is vital to support the practitioner at the front line in maintaining that trust relationship.
Okay, thanks very much. So in conclusion, bringing together the factors that you've told us about in both podcasts, how would you summarise the approaches that are most likely to bring about positive outcomes in self-neglect?
In summary, in direct work with individuals who are self-neglecting, the importance of building rapport and trust, empathy, persistence, continuity, it's about relationships and it's about demonstrating humanity. Seeking to understand the meaning and significance of the self-neglect, taking into account the individual's life experience. What is the meaning of the mess, for example? Working as much as possible at the pace of the individual and using those moments of motivation to try to make a difference. Keeping the individual's mental capacity constantly in view, and being very open and honest about the risks that you perceive and foresee and the possible options, including coercive action in response to those risks. Exploring options for intervention, thinking family, in order to understand what may be going on, but in order also to try to utilise an individual's social networks to make a difference.
But you can't achieve this kind of practice unless you have organisational and interagency support. So in summary, the organisational approaches that we see producing positive outcomes are where the strategic responsibility for self-neglect is clearly located within a shared interagency governance arrangement, such as the Safeguarding Adults Boards, where agencies share definitions and understandings of self-neglect and have a clear understanding of each other's legal powers and duties and roles. Where interagency coordination and shared risk management is facilitated by clear referral routes, clear communication channels, and clear decision-making, shared decision-making systems. And where longer-term supportive relationship-based involvement is accepted as a pattern of work in certain complex and high-risk cases. And where, finally, we have training and supervision that challenges and supports practitioners to engage with those ethical challenges we've discussed, to explore the legal options, to develop the skills and the emotions that are involved in self-neglect practice.
So essentially, in conclusion, best practice is characterised by whole system alignment. Following the principles of making safeguarding personal, the individual is at the core of our concerns. And the team around that individual is working to build relationships, continuity, trust. And that work around the individual is underpinned by legal and ethical literacy. It is underpinned by an organisational infrastructure that appreciates the research evidence and the importance of enabling people to build relationships with individuals who self-neglect, and that that organisational infrastructure is supported by a multi-agency governance set of arrangements, as we've outlined in the in this podcast, and is overseen by the Safeguarding Adult Board, essentially to enable the best research evidence to be implemented, as it were, on the ground. And all of that is underpinned by the overarching legal and policy frameworks that Parliament has determined.
That is the end of this podcast, which was the second of two podcasts. If you have found this thought-provoking and would like to follow it up, then you may want to look at a list of resources which Susie and Michael have provided on the Derby Derbyshire CCG's websites. Thank you, Susie and Michael, for giving us the important information on the second part of the findings from research into self-neglect, and in particular the implications for those adults at risk whom we see every day in our work.